You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The murder of 50 Muslim worshippers in Christchurch, New Zealand, has ignited an international conversation about Islamophobia. One Australian lawmaker even blamed Muslim immigrants for the attack by a white nationalist. I recently spoke with Khalid Baydoun, a law professor and a Detroiter who teaches on the intersection of constitutional law, race, and religion at the University of Arkansas. His new book is American Islamophobia, Understanding the Roots and Rise of Fear. I asked him about the history behind Islamophobia in the Western world. Here's our conversation. Welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me.
So there's a lot to unpack in the book. Let's get right to it. Let's start with a couple of definitions. Explain to us what private Islamophobia is, what's structural Islamophobia, and how do they feed into each other?
Private Islamophobia is pretty much the fear, hatred, animus that is coming from private individuals, citizens, individuals who might be your neighbors, classmates, your colleagues at work, effectively, indirectly, not tied to the state. These are individuals who are acting on their own merit. Structural Islamophobia, on the other hand, is the form of Islamophobia that is coming from the state itself by way of state-sponsored policy, law, presidential rhetoric, the rhetoric of senators, congressmen, and so forth. So there's a distinction there. It's an important distinction, but there's also a convergence where state-sponsored or structural Islamophobia intensifies, emboldens, abets the private Islamophobia we see on the ground.
Law enforcement and government officials would say, look, we didn't make that guy go down there with a rifle. We didn't make that guy who followed a woman into the Kroger grocery store in Dearborn and start hassling and shoving and abusing her. So why would you say that they feed into each other like that?
Well, it's not direct causation. It's not that there's a explicit dictate coming from the state that's actually mandating that individuals go and attack Muslims or individuals who look Muslim. But there is a relationship there, right? If the law is effectively based on the presumption that Muslim identity is presumptive or tied to terrorism, it is communicating something specific to private citizens.
Who was Edward Said and why is he important to understanding Islamophobia in the United States?
Edward Said is, in my opinion, one of the most important American intellectuals. He is somebody who closely studied how Islam is, you know, examined, is portrayed in the media, intellectual spaces. Wrote a really important book in 1979 called Orientalism. And the thesis behind Orientalism was that the West effectively defines itself in mirror opposite terms of the Orient. And the Orient here is synonymous with the Muslim world. So by virtue of this dialectic, this theory, if you will, we have these foundational baselines that give rise to modern Islamophobia. So, for instance, Orientalism holds that the Muslim world is backwards, it's static, it's always wet to war, it's savage, and so on and so forth. And through the embedment of these stereotypes, we see the production or reproduction of them through Islamophobia today.
Basically, they're our mirror opposite, where during the Cold War, we had another enemy, the communists, the Soviet Union. Now we lost that enemy, and we had to come up with a new enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So why did that fit so well into that narrative?
You know, Samuel Huntington, who I'm critical of in the book, has a poignant quote in one of his books. I think it's A Clash of Civilizations, where he writes, "In order to know ourselves, we have to know who our enemy is." That sort of like sets forth this geopolitical paradigm where the United States and most empires need a definitive rival in order to effectively define who they are. So after the fall of the Soviet Union in 1989, there was a void there. There was a void in terms of, you know, finding an empire, a civilization, a nation that we could effectively pit ourselves against. Islam and the monolithic Muslim world effectively filled that void, you know, after the walls came crumbling down in the Soviet Union.
You know, with the Iranian hostage situation in 79, the news media, a lot of people in the government, and even Hollywood quickly identified that new enemy. So tell us how that happened.
It didn't begin with the fall of the Soviet Union. It was always there. You know, in my academic research, I closely examine the 18th century and how Islam was effectively interpreted and portrayed by American courts. Again, through this system of Orientalism, there's always been this, at worst, demonization of Islam and Muslims, and at best, this idea that Muslims were this, you know, foreign class of people that could not be assimilated into the American, body politic or American society. What happens, though, is this proliferation of this representation and idea with the fall of the Soviet Union in 1989, then obviously it becomes prolific during the War on Terror.
In 1995, a federal building in Oklahoma City was blown up, 168 people killed, another 680 people injured. What were some of the news media's immediate responses?
I recall just flipping through the news. You know, back then you didn't go to social media. You went to the television to watch the news. You know, people like Connie Chung, Tom Brokaw, within a matter of minutes, you know, effectively making a pretty confident assessment that the culprits were Muslims, you know, saying things that this had the signature, the fingerprints of Muslim Middle Eastern terrorism and so on, without any modicum of evidence. They just rushed to it based on, you know, some sort of innate feeling or the power of stereotype. They were all proven wrong a couple of hours later.
Right, because it ended up being white domestic terrorist Timothy McVeigh and, of course, Terry Nichols from Michigan. Well, there's been this historic Islamophobia. How did things change for Muslims in America after the 9/11 attacks in 2001?
Yeah, so that, you know, that was a watershed moment that effectively, you know, implements the modern structural Islamophobic state. With 9/11, again, the culprits were largely Saudis, Wahhabi Muslims, a specific sliver of the broader global Muslim population. However, what happens is because people have a, you know, monolithic understanding of Muslims, they just categorically blamed all Muslims. As a consequence of that, we see, you know, in rapid time, policies like the Patriot Act, policies like NSEER's National Security Entry and Exit Registration System, which is effectively the Muslim registry before Trump calls it the Muslim registry, which was in place for 9 years. So the state, the establishment of the Department of Homeland Security, adopts a really robust, aggressive, and in my opinion, bigoted disposition towards Muslims in this country.
One of the things that's been interesting is it's not just Muslims who've been targeted.
Yeah.
Sikhs have been targeted because they somehow match the we'll use the word ignorant person's idea of what a Muslim looks like. Mm-hmm. Christian Arabs have been attacked as well. This Islamophobic behavior seems indiscriminate. How do you deal with something like that?
Yeah, I think that's an important point because it really distinguishes private Islamophobia from structural Islamophobia. And I think that's why we have to be careful with, you know, severing the two. So private Islamophobes typically can't tell the difference between a bona fide, legitimate Muslim and an individual, like you said, who kind of fits within the stereotypical caricature of who they think Muslims are. Sikh men, like you've stated, are oftentimes the primary victims of Islamophobia. However, the state knows who Muslims are. Structural Islamophobia and various state agencies specifically know who Muslims are in terms of race, ethnicity, sectarian belief, whether Sunni or Shia, class, and so on and so forth. But private Islamophobia is, again, driven by this racialized idea that Muslims look a certain way. And as a consequence of that, you have a whole range of non-Muslims who are targeted and vulnerable to Islamophobia.
In the wake of 9/11, how well did George W. Bush and his administration delineate between terrorists and Muslims as a whole?
There was a conflation, and this conflation with terrorism and Islam and Muslim identity drove the war on terror forward. So it was really callous. It was, in my opinion, strategic looking back. So I thought he did a you know, a terrible job. It was driven by bigotry because the idea was, and again, this underlies the war on terror, is that Muslim identity, any manifestation of Muslim identity, is presumptive of the possibility of terrorism. So, for instance, the more conservative one looked in terms of how they, you know, appeared as Muslims, the more they practiced their religion, the more they were critical in terms of their speech or positions towards American domestic or foreign policy, the more frequent they went home to their native homelands. I'm Egyptian, so the more I went back home to Egypt, that might raise red flag that I might be engaged in terrorism. So it was a bigoted policy, whereas maximizing your Muslim identity increases the prospect of you being policed or deemed suspicious by the state.
You're quite critical of Barack Obama in the book, and this is a man who started his presidency by addressing Muslims in Cairo, saying he was seeking a new beginning between the United States and Muslims around the world. In what ways do you feel he failed the Muslim American community?
It's tough to say. So a lot of this stuff is comparative assessment in terms of one presidential administration to the next. I would say the Obama administration was, in some respects, better and I think more sensitive to the conditions of Muslim Americans than the Bush administration. Clearly a better administration than the one we have in office right now. But yeah, Obama spearheads his administration by giving this really important speech in Cairo, where effectively the idea was it was his objective, it is administration's objective to mend the wounds of the war on terror. That was effectively the message behind his speech in Cairo. But what becomes discouraging and where things decline after that speech is a couple of things. First, in 2011, Obama enacts what I consider to be the most pernicious, nefarious form of structural Islamophobia, which is counter-radicalization policing. You know, and second, you know, President Obama was destructive in the kind of foreign policy he engaged in and some of the tactics. Drone attacks in Yemen, for instance, which is currently being ravaged by attacks by Saudi Arabia, increased in high measure under the Obama administration.
During the Donald Trump campaign and during his presidency, you write he's blurred the distinction between Muslims and terrorists. In what ways?
In a range of ways. Presidential rhetoric specifically, we could see during the campaign that, and it was strategic. You know, Trump knew that by effectively disavowing dog whistle politics, I mean, embracing explicit sort of appeals at Islamophobia, that that would galvanize a base. So when he says on December 7th that it was his objective to propose or institute a Muslim ban, he's doing something very specific. When he says to Anderson Cooper 6 months before being elected that Islam hates us, he's doing something very specific. He's appealing directly to this whole clash of civilizations idea that Samuel Huntington writes about in his book.
So given what we've learned from this book, I want to ask a question that's probably the hardest question you're going to get. What will it take to deal with Islamophobia in America?
A number of things. So, you know, in Michigan, for instance, what's happened in the last couple of months has been really encouraging, in my opinion. There's been a Muslim lash, if you will, to the Trump administration, evident through the increasing number of Muslim American politicians running for office. So I think that, you know, that is a manifestation of what needs to happen in order to diminish Islamophobia, but also dismantle Islamophobia. It's really vital. It's really important that we have Muslims in these halls of power to counter what Trump's saying, not relying on third parties or other individuals to speak on our behalf, but actually having representatives in the very halls of power is critical. Rashida Tlaib from Michigan, Ilhan Omar from Minnesota, but also politicians and candidates who fell short. The campaign of Abdul Sayyid, for instance, I view as a resounding victory, right? Because what it does is it demonstrates that Muslims can compete for the highest offices in this country during a moment of intense Islamophobia. That's an important message that we send not only to the Muslim community, but also broadly in America.
The book is American Islamophobia, Understanding the Roots and Rise of Fear. The author is Khalid Beydoun. Thanks very much for coming in. Yeah.